We are continuing in the study of the life of Jesus in the church calendar. The way the year kind of falls out is you have the weeks before Christmas. There's Advent, the time of preparation for Jesus' coming. Christmas is the time of celebration that Jesus has been come. And the time between Christmas and Lent is the time when you celebrate His life and the revelation that comes through His life that this is God in the flesh. Historically referred to as Epiphany. And we're going to be studying the life of Christ from the book of Matthew for the next several weeks until Easter. And we're going to continue that hopefully as long as I'm your pastor. So we will be reading from Matthew chapter 2 this morning. And I would encourage you to turn there or to look up to the screen and read with me the first 12 verses of the chapter, second chapter of Matthew. Hear the word of the Lord. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men came from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, In Bethlehem of Judea. For so it is written by the prophet, And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country. By another way. Please pray with me. Father, we pray that you would give us insight into your word and that we, like the wise men, would rejoice exceedingly with great joy as we come to Jesus. Amen. The ABC show, The Office, was preceded by a BBC series that if you had the right kind of sense of humor, you would find hilarious. If you're easily offended, stay away. But I confess, I found it pretty humorous. And the backstory of the whole series, of course, the main character is about the boss and how awful he was and how life in the office. Kind of the backstory that gave it momentum was the story of the receptionist and the salesman. And the receptionist, Dawn, was cute. But she was essentially a slave to her bad decisions. And the salesman, Tim, was, everyone liked him. He's a jokester personality. He was fun. He was winsome. But he had no initiative. And he was no leader. And ultimately had no chance of winning her. And throughout the series, kind of every series, a season ended with him asking her out and her saying no. Kind of build up, ask her out, no. And that's the way it ended. The show just kind of ended that way, no happy ending. And it came back for a Christmas special, and Dawn has moved off to the United States, and she's given up her dream of being an artist. And she comes back for this Christmas party. And Tim has gotten her name in the Secret Santa, and the last scene is her driving off, going back to the airport to go back to America to never come back. And as she's driving off, she opens this gift, as she's being driven off, she opens this gift, and she finds a paint set from Tim, and a note that says, never give up on your dream. And she, you don't know what's happening, of course, and they flash back to the final kind of hurrah of the series, and everybody's kind of toasting at the party, and all of a sudden she shows up, and she kisses Tim, and they live happily ever after, and real sweet, and wipe a tear, and move on. But that's a very winsome picture. It's a beautiful picture to me because he wins her by just sheer humility. How many times would you ask out somebody who just shoots you down time and again, who has humiliated you because you've been asking her out on national television, according to the show, and everybody knows you've been humiliated. And just out of sheer humility and out of how well he knows her, he wins her in the end. What I want you to see in this text this morning, what I really want to have happen is this. I want you to be amazed at how humble God is. That God, the creator of the universe, the all-powerful Lord of space, time, and dimension, is humble. Humble enough to speak to you in a way you understand. Humble enough to keep after you and to draw you to himself. And the question we ask for ourselves is we ask to those who do not come and worship. First, we're going to look at those who do not come and worship. And then we're going to see how God draws those who do. And the question for us is this: will we come and worship? Will we come and worship? Familiar story, Christmas story, you know, three kings, you got the little nativity sets, you know, they got this funny looking turbans, they got the little gifts out on their knees. And I want to try to rescue the story from that because it needs to be rescued from that. And put it into real life and give you a sense of what really is happening here so you understand the story. And the first thing I want you to see, the first character I'm going to point to is Herod. King Herod, king over Israel. He's been put in place. His kingship is upheld by the Romans. And what you need to know about him, the most important thing for you to know about him in the backdrop of this story is this. He has taken the name for himself, King of the Jews. Okay, so when this entourage from the east come into town, and everybody's, it had to be a huge group, right? This is no secret emissary. This is not like Oprah sneaking in and we all found out about it 3 days later. This is this enormous group that's got the whole city of Jerusalem nervous. And they come in and they make a great first impression, don't they? We want to see the King of the Jews. You kind of imagine Herod, like, oh, you know, foreign emissaries coming to see me. And they look at him and go, no, the real king. Not you. The baby. And so he's furious. And he begins conspiring to search this king out and destroy him. Protect his throne. Why is that important for us to think about? Well, the first thing you see here is you can't have two kings. Herod is not at all interested in worshiping because he wants to be the king. And you know why you're not really interested in worship? Because you're like me. You kind of want to be the king too. I've been listening to a series by Jack Miller, and he talks about a day real early in his Christian life when he was reading through the book of Ephesians, and he got ticked off. Because he's reading through the book of Ephesians, and he's actually understanding it, which goes a step beyond me. And he understands that what Ephesians is saying here is he gets no credit for his salvation. And he gets mad. And he begins praying in his angry voice. What? Who are you? What do you mean you get all the glory? What do you mean you get all the credit? Who do you think you are anyway? And he says, the voice came back sharply saying, God, who do you think you are anyway? And Dr. Miller responded, God. And that's what's going on in our life, isn't it? We get mad. We need to realize that about ourselves. We want to be the caller of the shots. We want the credit when things go right. We want to have somebody else to be angry at when things go wrong. We want everything to kind of come into the alignment to make us comfortable and happy. And denying the fact that you want to be the king doesn't make it less true. That's what we want. We are angry that more of history doesn't revolve around us. We are angry that more people don't recognize us. And ultimately, we're all like Charlie Brown's little sister Sally, stamping our feet, going, I just want what I've got coming to me. I just want what I deserve. Don't you? Ask yourself the question, how easy is it for you to feel slighted? How often do you leave a gathering feeling like you didn't really get recognized as much as you ought to have been recognized? So-and-so wasn't as nice to you as they ought to have been. Why ought? Because you're the king. And you want to be treated that way. And so, when we realize that there's two kings, we have two choices. We can either humble ourselves, we can either abdicate the throne and worship the true king, or we can seek to eradicate the other. There can only be one king. And so what does the Herod do? He decides to go and destroy the child. And you think, well, I got a free pass on that one, right? I haven't sought to kill God lately. But we do seek to eradicate him as much as possible. We want to have him have as little say in our life as we possibly can. And we know that. How often, ask yourself simply this, how often is the name of Jesus on your lips? How much through the day of how we live do we, when something happens, do we give him the glory? When something bad happens, do we submit to his will? Both in our anger and our joy, we show that we've eradicated Jesus. When we're disciplining our children, do we point them to the gospel? When we're encouraging our children. You know, it's very, I found it funny because I'm not a girl, right? So when I was ministering to girls, I found it hilarious to find out how many of them, when they came home from school with their feelings hurt, their mothers would seek to encourage them with these haunting words, honey, you're much prettier than they are. We do that. We're always seeking out, well, you know, you don't have to worry about them. You're better than them. You're a good person anyway, without ever encouraging them in Jesus. Without ever talking to them about who they are in Jesus. We've eradicated them from our life. Example, one day a friend of mine came down the street. He was in a terrible mood because he's an insurance salesman, and he'd done all this work, just hours of work, get a bid ready, and the secretary had failed to tell the manager that his bid was ready. The manager never got the message, supposedly, and so they went with another company. And all of his work was not turned down, wasn't evaluated and turned down. It was never seen. And he came down the street and was, you know, we were throwing the football, and he was mad. And I said, well, you want the neighbor or you want the preacher? He said, well, give me both, and I'll decide later. And I said, well, the neighbor says that really stinks, and continue throwing the football. And the preacher says, isn't it good to know your fate doesn't rest in the hands of irresponsible secretaries, but your fate rests in the hands of the one who loves you so much he gave his only son. He never got back to me as to which was better. But where do you go? Where do you go for comfort? How hard is it for you to go back to that and remember that your identity, your value, your future, your life is in the hand of the Lord who loves you so much, He gave His Son for you? How easy is it for you to push Him off the throne? So we have Herod the Horrible who seeks to eradicate Jesus. But let's move on from there. That was not a very uncomfortable subject. Let's talk about the scholars. What does Herod do? He goes and he asks the scribes and the chief priests, where's the Savior to be born? And they tell him, and they get it right. They know their Bible. He's to be born in Bethlehem of Judea. There's more than one Bethlehem, and they knew the right one. They got it right. Now, since this never comes up in the nativity scenes, you probably think, right, whatever. What else is supposed to happen? But ask yourself this question. What's missing? If you spent your entire career studying the Scriptures, expecting something to happen, and then somebody comes to you and asks where it's supposed to happen, and there's this entourage of foreign emissaries going to the place where it's supposed to happen, wouldn't you expect the next sentence to say, "And so the scribes and chief priests ran to Bethlehem to find him"? And we're told nothing. Isn't that interesting? The people who got it right for the right reasons, and we're going to go over this in a second, but the people who come from the east are following a star. That's not a very reliable source of wisdom on the coming of Jesus. The people who studied the Scriptures and found them where they were supposed to find him do nothing. Isn't that interesting? I think it's interesting. And I think it's interesting for two reasons. One, because it shows us the danger of knowing the Bible. It's dangerous to know the Bible. Because all you have to do is get a little bit of Bible knowledge and you can avoid everything somebody throws at you. If you know enough of the Bible to be able to pick something apart when someone's telling you something, you can ignore it. It's really convenient. I remember when I was in seminary, and I was listening to one of my professors preach, and he was preaching about how the first command, the thing that we as believers, the reason why we exist, is to love God and our neighbor. That was a fine topic, right? We wouldn't disagree with that. But you see, what he did was this. He started his sermon off by saying the Westminster Confession might be wrong when it says the chief end of man is to glorify God. Well, that's all you had to say to me, right? So I can ignore everything else you're about to say. And all that convicting stuff about loving my neighbor, missed me. Because I know the Bible better than that. We exist to glorify God, so it's real easy when you know your Bible to ignore what's being taught, to ignore the point. Because I know the Bible, so I don't really need Jesus. I know the Bible, so I can avoid the truth of what's happening. That happened to, you know, that happened to people throughout Jesus' life. Whenever people were coming out to him, there would always be somebody saying, "Yeah, but he wasn't born where he was supposed to be born. Yeah, but he came, Joseph with his dad, nobody's supposed to know who the Messiah's dad is." Isn't that interesting? It was always that tendency to use the Bible to keep from worshiping Jesus. We do that. If we can find something wrong, something unbiblical with what the preacher says or with how he says it, then we can hide from the Bible altogether. The second thing that I think is interesting about this is maybe they really did think he was being born. They were just unwilling to go. Maybe their thought was, Bethlehem, yeah, we need to go check it out tomorrow. That happens to me a lot. Oftentimes, I know exactly where God is, but going to find Him is going to be a little uncomfortable. This Christmas, I was praying, as I often do, and I was praying, and I was praying for y'all. I was praying for us as a church, and I was kind of going over the history of our church and where we've been. And I was getting kind of urgent. I was saying, "God, I just don't want to miss anything. I feel like we're really close to a precipice here. We're building momentum. We have people seeking you. And I don't want to miss anything." And the answer came back pretty clearly. "Well, if you don't want to miss anything, then you need to get this particular sin out of your life." And so I quit praying. I got up and decided it was time for me to get some exercise. And I put my walking shoes on. And very consciously went, "Okay, later. But not now." And that's common. That's a very true story. That happens to us a lot, doesn't it? If you want godliness, if you want Christ, you know what to do. You know where He is. I think a lot of men in our church are in danger right now. I think, because this fall, you know, a lot of us really kind of had a dealing with Jesus that we hadn't had in a while. And together we got together and decided that we weren't going to settle for kind of the Christianity that we we've lived our whole life up until now. We've lived with a Christianity kind of knowing that there's more to it than this and not really knowing where to get it. And we got together and we talked about pursuing holiness together and about confession and about eradicating sin from our life. And I think a lot of us just kind of left it there with, yeah, that would be great tomorrow. And in the 100 days since, I've seen one person finish the 60-day program. I don't know. To my knowledge, we all struggle with this joint kind of feeling within us. And one of just knowing the religion we experience is impotent. On the other level, experience is not being willing to go for, to strive after what we need to complete it. So there's Herod the horrible, not Hagar the horrible, and the self-satisfied scholars. Let's move on to the good portion of this talk, shall we? I think it's time. Let's not look at the bad people anymore. Let's move on to the good news of Jesus, the joyful pagans. For those of you who weren't able to come and worship with us on Christmas Eve, let me kind of jar your memory a little bit about who these guys were, okay? Hear the phrase wise men in the Bible. Wisdom means you have God in His place, you're worshiping God, you're studying the wisdom of God. That's not who they were. I think wise men is a cleaned up, sanitized translation. They were magi. Magi, pretty easy to see what word that comes from. They were magicians. They were priests in the religion of Babylon and Persia. They were experts in magic and in astrology. Guess what? All of those things are condemned by God. Astrology, magic, and the religion of the Babylonians and Persians, all condemned. They were bad people. They were bad people. And yet, we see them coming to Jesus, and when they hear where He's born, and again, when they see the star, they rejoice exceedingly with great joy, and they fall down and they worship Him, giving Him their gifts. There's three things I want you to see about that. And the first thing is this, the amazing humility of God. How did they find Jesus? Through a star. When was the last time you saw a star and followed it? Never. Why? Because you're not an astrologer. Why? Because you're not supposed to be an astrologer. Astrology is bad. You understand that? Astrology bad. God used it to draw people to Jesus. God used something bad to draw people to Jesus. He will communicate through any means. He communicates through every means. He draws people to Jesus. And it's amazing as you begin to talk with people and share stories with people how often that's true. I had a mentor one time. I was working in the inner city and I made some terrible, terrible mistakes, and we're not going to go into those, but he was trying to encourage me by telling me how God redeems mistakes. And he said, "This is one of the worst mistakes I ever made was I was trying to do evangelism with a guy and it didn't work, so I smoked a joint with him." And I was like, okay, that would be a mistake, yes. And he said this, it's fascinating. He said, when the guy saw me roll a joint and it became clear to him that I had done that before, he got converted. Because as he saw that, he went, "You know what you're doing. You really were like me." Now, and he was very clear, I should not have done that. But God used it. God uses everything. He uses bad preachers. He uses terrible evangelistic methods. You understand that? He uses terrible methods to draw people to Himself. He might even use you. He might use me. He uses freak accidents. He uses long-term illness. And I want that to comfort you. I want that to comfort you to minister. I really do. But more importantly, I want that to comfort you as you understand who God is. God is humbly the one who keeps asking the girl out after she turns Him down a dozen times. He is the one seeking a method to get around your obstacles. He is the one seeking you. And for some reason, we kind of get that in evangelism. Like, okay, God came to find me. That's good. But from that point on, we begin to think that God's standing up there, kind of like this, waiting for us to get in our chairs and get everything right. Kind of that attitude of, well, I came and found you once, but from now on you're supposed to be here and on time, and you need to be getting it right. And that's not the God of the Bible. He is humble, and He is seeking after us, and His arms are open, and He is gracious. And as that begins to hammer into you, and you believe God's graciousness, you believe that He's the God who seeks after sinners, then you begin to show mercy to the people around you. Once you believe that you have actually received mercy, you begin to show it to others. That's what He's like. And how do we then come? How do we respond to that humility? With great joy. I love this text. Matthew's really trying to get it through to us. They rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. In case you were thinking they rejoiced exceedingly with great sorrow. You know, like, what else are they going to rejoice with? It was great joy. They found it. The amazing thing is, once you find the true King, once you begin to worship the true King, you get surprised by something. You get surprised by the joy you find in Him. It's not what you think. You give up seeking after yourself. You give up seeking after your own comfort and your own ease. And you find joy. You're surprised by it. You didn't expect it there. I think it's because of this. I think when you were trying to serve yourself, when you were trying to manipulate the world to please you, or to at least recognize you, you were serving a bad king. You were serving things that weren't going to satisfy you. You were serving a king that had no mercy. And you did a terrible job of being king. You did a terrible job of saving your children. You went around angry that you couldn't even make yourself happy. You were angry that you weren't living the life you ought to live. Again, I hate to keep talking about myself, but that's all I've had to think about for the last 3 weeks. Now I'm back with you, so next week I'll talk about you. But I had to fill out something recently, and it said, ask about kind of your major emotions or whatever, and I wrote on there, for the last 2 weeks, my primary emotion has been anger at myself. See, I really thought I would be better than this by now. See, what am I doing? I'm saying my king is doing a pretty cruddy job of satisfying me, and I'm sick of him. And I'm thinking about me. And I've made my achievement, my holiness, my sanctification, my ministry, my gentle spirit, my king. And it fails me every time. And I stay mad. And when you throw that king away and you come to the true one and you find grace and you find one who never failed you, and you're just worshiping and you're not even thinking about yourself, and all of a sudden you kind of do look down accidentally and you realize, I'm not mad anymore. I was mad. I'm not mad anymore. And you find joy. And if you don't have that joy, I would just ask you, why not? And it's not because you're a bad person. I'm not going to stand up here and say, well, if you don't have joy, you need joy. You're commanded to be joyful, so go get some joy. That didn't work. But I am telling you, I'm asking you, are you worshiping the true King? Because worshiping Him brings joy. And worshiping Him is a sacrificial, humbling act. They fell down, they worshipped Him, and they opened their treasures and they offered Him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. Why does worship involve giving gifts? I think one of the things we're doing is we're saying, this is what I used to worship, and it's worthless. It did nothing to make me whole. Take it. It's showing somebody what they're worth, and it's a joyful act. And some of you who are still skeptical of the church and cynical of the church, you probably think, here it comes. He's about to tell us, if we really worship God, we're going to put a lot of money in the offering plate. And I'm going to tell you exactly the opposite. If you are not absolutely convinced that Jesus is all that you need, if you're not absolutely convinced that Jesus is all your joy, you are not invited to put a penny in my offering plate. You're not twisting his arm. We give because we love him. We give because we realize he is the gracious king. Does that sound, it's pie in the sky business. That ain't true. That never happens in real life, does it? Nobody gives joyfully. You ever seen a young man who just bought an engagement ring? Is he mad about how much he just spent? If he is, girls, don't take it. He's joyful. This silly, worthless money, I get to give it away for something that's absolutely as useless as a piece of jewelry. Because she is my joy. That's what happens when we come to Jesus. We find out He is our joy. He is our worship. And we want to show Him what He's worth. Please come with me and let's worship the King by giving Him His tithes and our offerings. Please pray with me.